Shabbat Shalom and welcome to Kehilat Tenuva, The Harvest, a Messianic Charismatic congregation in Thornton, Colorado. You're listening to the Shabbat message delivered by Senior Pastor Mark McClellan. Our goal is to provide, for free, the message of the Torah from a Messianic Judaic perspective. Here's Pastor Mark.
Preservation, perseverance. This message is about God's sovereign plan for His chosen people. Now, as mentioned previously, this is part two of a four-part series on the book of Esther. Pastor Mark presented part one last week and will present parts three and four over the next 2 weeks as we prepare for the festival of Purim. Because we have a mixed multitude in our congregation with a diverse background, it is impossible to know who has knowledge and understanding of the book of Esther and who doesn't. So to effectively relate the story contained in the book, it is necessary to read the book. So today, part two of this series would deal with Esther chapter 2, starting in verse 19 and going through chapter 4, verse 17. And while I will not read every verse, I will read most of them. And we will put them on the monitors so you can follow along as I read. Okay? So, also as a prelude, I should emphasize that the book of Esther is very symbolic. And it's both historical and prophetic, in that it shows how God has always provided a plan for the preservation of His chosen people, and how the enemy has always sought to destroy that which God loves most. Originally, mankind, the very pinnacle of God's creation, and then more specifically, His chosen people, the Jews, and then His people who are grafted in to the house of Israel by Yeshua, our Messiah. So there are four key issues within the section of this book of Esther that I want you to take note of. Number one, Mordecai's loyalty to King Ahasuerus, even though the king was pagan. Number two, Mordecai's unwavering commitment to God, his steadfastness to live by his convictions, and if necessary, to die for his beliefs rather than reject them. Number three, the rise to power of Haman, symbolic of the evil in our world, and his plan to exterminate the Jews due to his hatred of them. And number four, the perseverance of God's people when they determine to rise up, take their place of authority in the face of grave persecution, unwilling to bend or bow to their oppressors, but trusting God for their protection and deliverance, as demonstrated primarily by Mordecai and Esther. Now, as a means of emphasis, I want to briefly mention, from a chronological and historical perspective, the evil kingdoms the enemy has used to oppress God's chosen people, the Jews. First was Egypt, ruled by Pharaoh, who enslaved the Jews. Second was Assyria, who conquered the Jews and carried them away into their country as slaves. Third was Babylon, ruled at that time by Nebuchadnezzar, who also conquered the Jews and who also carried them away as slaves. And then fourth was Medo-Persia, ruled by several kings over a period of time. Now, the timing in which the story contained in the book of Esther occurs was under the rule of King Ahasuerus. Now, you may have heard his name pronounced Xerxes. Xerxes would be the Greek translation. We're going to be consistent, and we're going to stay with Ahasuerus. Okay? Now, I want to stay here for just a moment and make a couple of important points. Many years prior to the events in the book of Esther, after the Persians defeated the Babylonian Empire and King Cyrus came to power, he allowed the Jews to return their homeland, but many of them chose not to return. Now, you may recall from part one that there were two returns of the Jews to their homeland during the period of time that spans 60 years between the first return and the second return. The events in the book of Esther occurred between these two returns. Also, the events in the book of Esther are the first time that there is an effort to not only enslave the Jews, but to totally annihilate them. Fifth was Greece after the death of Alexander the Great, when Antiochus Epiphanes took control of a portion of the empire that included the Jews' homeland. It was during this period that the events associated with Hanukkah occurred. And we know from the historical accounts recorded primarily in the book of Maccabees that it was a period of brutal and violent oppression of the Jews, whereby many died horrible deaths. Sixth was Rome, primarily under Herod, who maintained an oppressive control of the Jews and who slaughtered thousands of them. We are most likely familiar with a relatively more recent period of history, as much of the writings in the four Gospels addresses the oppression and cruelty imposed on the Jews by the Romans. Seventh was the Third Reich, i.e. Nazi Germany under Hitler. This was the second time in history that the oppressors sought the total annihilation of the Jews. And this was obviously a very dark time for the Jews in history. Now the eighth, which we are witnessing in our days, is not a single nation or empire, but a global ideology of radical Islam. It is the third to seek the total annihilation of the Jews. And now, not only the Jews, but also the Christians. Now, there are three common themes that emerge from this historical perspective. First of all, in all these evil kingdoms, each ruler or leader was used by Satan to accomplish his objectives of oppressing and destroying the Jews. This has not changed, since he still uses people today, influenced by demonic powers, to continue his attempts to destroy not only the Jews, but all of those who are grafted in to Israel. Secondly, the second common theme, God also uses his people to rise up at their appointed time according to his plan to fulfill their destiny which he has ordained. Now, God has a greater purpose for each person than just being saved and sitting idle till he returns. Now, most of the time, doing something for God requires faith, trust, and obedience. But it always, always requires action on our part. Now, when Yeshua told the story in Luke 19 of his going away and returning, and he told his people, "Occupy till I come," he did not mean for his people to be sitting idle. He meant being active, working, serving, taking control, and exercising the authority that he delegated to us. The third common theme, generally, each time the ruler or leader of the Jews did what was right in the sight of God, the people followed his lead, and all Israel lived in peace and prosperity. But each time the ruler or leader turned from God and did evil, God allowed hardships, including invading armies to come against Israel, overtake the Jews, and subject them to oppressive conditions, resulting in the death of many of them. evil kingdoms that rose up against the Jews under Satan's influence were actually fulfilling the purposes of God, which was to cause his people to repent, to turn from their wicked ways, and to return to him. Now, Proverbs 29, verse 2 reads, "When the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. But when a wicked man rules, the people groan." This has always been true, and it is still true today. That brings me to the introduction. And I probably thought that was the introduction. That was not the introduction. This is the introduction. Everything I've shared with you so far today has been to give you a better historical perspective and to help demonstrate the ongoing conflict between good and evil, God and Satan, as it pertains to the Jews and now to all of us who are part of God's chosen people through being grafted in by Yeshua. Now, Pastor Mark ended part one of the series last week with Esther discovering the providence of God in her life, finding favor with the king, and her ascension to queen of the Persian Empire. So now let's pick up with part two, which deals primarily with Haman's wicked plot. So we'll start in Esther chapter 2, verse 21. "In those days, while Mordecai sat at the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on a gallows. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king." Now, if y'all could just keep 23 up there for just a minute, please. As mentioned in my comments regarding the key issues contained in this portion of the book of Esther, here we see key issue number one: Mordecai's loyalty to King Ahasuerus. Now, by all indications, King Ahasuerus had continued in the way of his predecessors to be relatively benevolent to the people who he had conquered throughout the entire Persian Empire. And as noted, many of the Jews had chosen to stay rather than return to their homeland, which I think further indicates this level of benevolence. Now, this seemingly minor note that's contained in the 23rd verse, where it says, regarding this event being written in the book of the Chronicles, could be easily overlooked. We could just read it and move on. But it is an important item, as it will play a part in the actions of King Ahasuerus later in the story to Mordecai's benefit. So let's go now to chapter 3, beginning in verse 1. "After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. And all the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage." Now it appears, although a pagan, King Ahasuerus was, as I mentioned, was a benevolent king. So Satan was apparently unable to use him to do his evil against the Jews. Another man was raised up in a position of power and authority that was a willing accomplice to Satan. Now throughout history, Satan has had no problem finding men, and sometimes women, who were ready, willing, and able to join his cause and perpetuate evil and oppress the righteous. Sometimes it was blatant, and sometimes more subtle. But make no mistake, that evil intent is just as real today as it has been for centuries. And don't think for a moment that any of us are immune or that we can survive on our own. We need each other. And being part of a community like the Harvest is crucial. These are evil days that we live in. Now, it was a common thing for kings to view themselves as deity and to require their subjects to acknowledge them as such and pay homage or to bow as in worship. King Ahasuerus, in his promotion of Haman, extended the same level of respect and recognition by commanding it to be so. Now, as mentioned in my comments regarding the key issues contained in this portion of the book of Esther, here we see key issue number two, Mordecai's unwavering commitment to God and his steadfastness to live by his convictions. Now, as a dedicated Jew, he could not and would not bow to anyone or anything other than the God of Israel, even if it meant putting his life in jeopardy. So let's pick up with verse 3. Then the king's servants who were within the king's gate, said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" Now it happened when they spoke to him daily, and he would not listen to them, that they told it to Haman, to see whether Mordecai's words would stand. For Mordecai had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage, Haman was filled with wrath. So here we have Haman riding high on his ego after being promoted and proclaimed to be like the king. And he is confronted with this detestable Jew who would not only not bow and pay homage, but he defies the command to do so openly for all to see. And this obviously was a great source of irritation for him. Now, it seems like in our days, many people still see the Jews as detestable. Anti-Semitism is still rampant around the world. And in case you haven't noticed, the rise of anti-Christian sentiment is just as much, or even worse, today in many of our societies. Let's pick up and chat in verse 6. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Azarias, the people of Mordecai. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Azarias, they cast her, that is, the lot, before Haman to determine the day and the month until it fell on the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Now, this word used here, her, which is Purim, or Purim, in the plural, means lots. And it is where we get the term used to identify this festival that we call Purim. Now, I will say more about the timing of the casting of lots and the timing determined by the casting of lots for the destruction of the Jews a little bit further into the story. And when I do, you will see that even in this, God's providence was working to facilitate his plan for the preservation of the Jews. I'd like to go now to verse 8. Then Haman said to King Azarias, "There's a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other peoples, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they may be destroyed." So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, "The people are given to you to do with as it seems good to you." Now, as commented early regarding the keys contained in this portion of the book of Esther, here we see key issue number 3, the rise to power of Haman. As I mentioned before, symbolic of the evil in our world and his plan to exterminate the Jews because of his hatred. Now, it's probably worth noting that King Ahasuerus, who we determined to be mostly benevolent, is also mostly ambivalent about who these people are and about their pending destruction. Picking up now in verse 12. Then the king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month, and the decree was written according to all that Haman commanded, to the king's satraps, to the governors who were over each province, to the officials of all people, to every province according to its script, and to every people in their language. In the name of King Ahasuerus it was written and sealed with the king's signet ring. And the letters were sent by couriers into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. A copy of the document was to be issued as law in every province, being published for all people, that they should be ready for that day. Now, in verse 12, we read that this occurred on the 13th day of the first month. Now, if we understand that this book is written from a Jewish perspective, we as Messianic people who observe the Torah should immediately identify what that date was. Right? Everybody knows? No? So, it was the day before the 14th day of Nisan. That makes sense, right? So when we say the 14th day of Nisan, now we know what that day is, right? Everybody know? You still have to know. So the 14th day of Nisan is the beginning of Pesach, right? Now, I don't know if that was just coincidence, or was it again God's providence that the decree for the destruction of the Jews would be written on the day prior to the day marking the beginning of Pesach, when the deliverance of the Jews is celebrated each year? Maybe, just maybe. Maybe God allowed this as a reminder to his people. I delivered you from Pharaoh of Egypt. I can deliver you from Haman of Persia. How about that? Huh? Also notice the date chosen by the casting of lots was the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. So there was an 11-month period of time between when the decree was written and the day it was to be carried out. Now, is this also perhaps God's providence at work to allow time for his plan for the preservation of the Jews to develop? Ever thought about if that proclamation decree had just been carried out immediately? But the casting of the lots put the date for the destruction in the future, quite a ways in the future. I think God's hand. So let's go to chapter 4, beginning in verse 1. When Mordecai learned all that had happened, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city. He cried out with a loud and bitter cry. He went as far as the front of the king's gate, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. In every province where the king's command and decree arrived, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. Now, we would assume that while the decree was made known immediately, it may have taken days or perhaps even weeks for the decree to reach the distant parts of the vast Persian Empire. But as the decree arrived in the various provinces, it was met with the same reaction among the Jews: fear and dread. Let's pick up now in verse 4. So Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her, and the queen was deeply distressed. Then she sent garments to clothe Mordecai and take his sackcloth from him. But he would not accept them. Then Esther called Hadak, one of the king's eunuchs, whom he had appointed to attend her. And she gave him a command concerning Mordecai to learn what and why this was. So Hadak went out to Mordecai in the city square that was in front of the king's gate. And Mordecai told him all that had happened to him. He also gave him a copy of the written decree for their destruction, which was given at Shushan, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her, and that he might command her to go into the king and make supplication to him and plead before him for her people. So Hadak returned and told Esther the words of Mordecai. Now it appears that Esther's first thoughts when hearing of the decree were to attempt to comfort Mordecai by sending him garments to replace his sackcloth. Now, although the story says she was distressed, perhaps she was not yet fully acknowledging the severity of the situation. Mordecai, on the other hand, quickly turns his focus to recognizing that Esther, as the queen, is well positioned to intercede on behalf of her people, the Jews, and circumvent Haman by appealing directly to King Ahasuerus. So let's pick up in verse 10. Then Esther spoke to Hadak and gave a command for Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court of the king who has not been called has but one law: put all to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, and he may live. Yet I myself have not been called to go into the king in these 30 days. Now, if we take a little bit of liberty to read into the story what isn't said, we can almost picture Esther thinking, I went through a difficult adolescence. I lost both my parents. I was snatched away at a young age and sent to be part of the king's harem. Now, after all that, I have become queen. My life is good. And you want me to risk losing my life to help people who I have no affiliation or relationship with? I mean, honestly, can you really blame Esther for thinking like that? I mean, you know, self-preservation is a powerful motivator, right? Especially when life is good, when you're the queen, right? Now, I would say at this point, Esther certainly did not have the God of Israel, who had been her protector and her provider all of her life, and her thoughts. I think it's safe to say that. So let's go to verse 12. So they told Mordecai Esther's words, and Mordecai told them to answer Esther, do you think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews? If you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Now, Mordecai first provides Esther with a reality check by reminding her that as a Jew, she too is subject to the decree. He also makes a very strong faith declaration that relief and deliverance would arise for the Jews because he had ultimately placed his trust and confidence in the God of Israel. And he knew God had never allowed his chosen people to be totally annihilated and had no doubt that he would not allow them to be annihilated this time either. Mordecai then challenges Esther with the idea that by God's providence, her entire life had been in God's hands. And it was God who positioned her as queen as a means to counter the plans of Satan to destroy God's people through an evil man under Satan's control. And he coins this well-known phrase, "For such a time as this." Verse 15. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go, gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther had commanded. Esther, now realizing the severity of Haman's decree, that is, the annihilation of all the Jews throughout the entire Persian Empire, and that she was not immune, has a complete change in her thinking, calls for a fast, and boldly declares her intent to approach King Ahasuerus without being summoned in violation of the law, acknowledging she would do so at risk of her own life. As I mentioned in my comments earlier regarding the key issues in this portion of the book of Esther, we are about to see key issue number 4, the perseverance by God's people when they determine to rise up, take their place of authority in the face of great persecution, unwilling to bend or bow to their oppressors, but trusting God for their protection and deliverance, as we are beginning to see demonstrated by Mordecai and Esther. The providence of God in our life is not to raise us up for our own fulfillment, but so we can be willing and able to fulfill the greater purpose for which he has destined us. So in summary, I titled part 2 of this series, Providence, Preservation, and Perseverance. I hope that by exploration and explanation of this portion of the book of Esther, you have been able to see God's providence in operation. Recognize his plan throughout history for the preservation of his people, and comprehend the power of determined perseverance through faith, trust, and obedience to God. I also hope each person will look closely at your own life and see all the times God's providence was at work. Just think about this. Of the approximately 7 billion people in the world today, how is it that you live in America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, the greatest nation on earth? How is it that all those people, many who are pagans or serve false gods, out of all those people, that you were drawn into a personal relationship with Yeshua the Messiah? How is it that of all the people who confess to be Christians, you were called out to return to your Jewish roots of the Christian faith and to begin walking according to Torah. Can you reflect on your life and see God's providence working in your life? For me, perhaps most, when we look at our life, we see times when God's preservation was there, keeping us from destruction, either from our own foolish actions or the actions of wicked people that we came in contact with. And lastly, just the mere fact that you are here pursuing God, determined to live according to His Word, His will, and His ways, despite the difficulties, despite the disappointments, despite the distractions, that you are here pursuing God shows a determined perseverance. So as we enter the season of Purim, be encouraged by the story that's contained in the book of Esther, and remember the words of Paul recorded in Romans 8:28. We know all things work together for good for those who love God and to those who are called according to His purpose. Now next week, Pastor Mark will pick up the story in part 3, which deals with the triumph of Mordecai over Haman. Shabbat Shalom, Pastor Mark.
Thank you, Dennis. That connects really well with where I'm going and in this series. Just great thoughts, great ideas, and very relevant for our lives today. We see that global rising again, like we've seen over and over and over, to come against the Jewish people. Our great hope is all these great empires are going to get it done. I don't think ISIS is either. I think it's going down in flames too. You know, this is almost like the reoccurring theme of history, of the struggle between good and evil. And the God of Israel, the God of the Jewish people. And listening to Dennis, I couldn't help but think, not only has this been a problem throughout the ages, but it's an embarrassment in some ways to realize that the church got caught up in the anti-Semitism and became one of the greatest persecutors of Jewish people over the last 2,000 years. And a lot of that has turned around over the last 15, 20 years. Big turnaround in the church. And the church is finally getting it right and finally beginning to realize, wait a minute, God is still God and the Jews are still the Jews. Nothing's changed. The new covenant was with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not with the Gentiles, but with Israel. The good news is God's going to bring the Gentiles in to His covenant people, Israel. And they're going to participate in this great plan of salvation. And so all of this is coming to pass, and the church is beginning to understand it, and there's a big turnaround that's taking place. I want to say that one of the big mistakes in history is this idea, well, you know, the Jewish people, they weren't very obedient, and over again they apostatized, and finally God rejected them. So the story goes. It's not true, but that's been the theology, the theological underpinnings within the church, is that God somehow rejected His people because of their disobedience. Now, Paul says that's foolishness in Romans chapter 9, 10, and 11. He says God has foreknowledge. God is perfect in His foreknowledge. He knows all things from the beginning. Everything that would ever happen, He already knew what happened. And knowing that, He chose Jacob and his descendants. Knowing ahead of time that Jacob and his descendants would not be very obedient, but actually would disobey over and over and over. He knew that. He wasn't surprised. He chose them knowing that. Because disobedience does not in any way undermine his faithfulness towards them. And that's the key to understand. The church hasn't been very, very obedient either. Yeah, the church has done more with idolatry than any other people group on the face of the earth. If we can be rejected for disobedience, then we're in trouble. Yeah. So let me just read this to you just to kind of follow up with what Dennis was saying, because I think it's important for us to understand this very, very important matter. Because I'll tell you what, it's a spirit. It makes no sense. It makes no sense. And you can read books. I've read books and books, written on the Holocaust and anti-Semitism. And it's just, it's an insanity. It's like a mental illness. You really can't find what this root is. You know, what is this hatred of the Jewish people for being Jewish? It makes no sense, right? And so just, thinking of this whole idea of what it is, I think the best explanation is it's not very rational. It's evil. It comes from the evil one. He hates God, and he hates his people. He can't touch God, but he can touch his people. So he touches his people. He seeks to destroy them, to strike at the heart of God. And this is the root of anti-Semitism. And it's very slick, it's very sophisticated, refined, and a lot of people get thrown off guard and get sucked into it. I'm saying be careful. Don't let that happen. The Jewish people are like the what do they call that? The parakeet in the mine shaft. What do they have down there? Canary. There you go. They're like cousins, right? I don't know. I'm not a birdologist or whatever that would be. Yeah. As goes the Jews, so goes the kingdom. We are called to align ourselves with the Jewish people. We are grafted in to the believing element within Judaism. There's been believing Jews in every generation. There's more believing Jews in Messiah in this generation than there's ever been in any other generation outside of the first century. And so you can see tremendous amounts of Jewish people coming into faith in Messiah. And those larger elements of Jews that don't believe in the Messiah yet, the Word of God is very clear that there's going to be a revival among Israel as a nation at the end of the age that comes in on the heels of the Gentiles and making them all crazy jealous. So, I want to read this for you just so you can understand the faithfulness of God. It was never based on the faithfulness of his people. That's shaky ground. You're saved by grace through faith, based on the faithfulness of Messiah, not your faithfulness. If it was, shaky ground, right? Listen to this. Psalms 89. Speaking of God's promise to David, that David, you and your descendants are forever. You will be my people forever. The kingdom is an eternal kingdom. You and your descendants, you will have a descendant that will be eternally on the throne forever. And your descendants, plural, will serve underneath his reign forever and ever and ever. Speaking of that, he says this in verse 30. If his, David's sons, speaking of Jewish descendants of David, if his sons forsake my law and do not walk in my judgments, if they violate my statutes and do not keep my commandments, then I will visit their transgression with the rod and their iniquity with stripes. But I will not break off my loving kindness from him, nor deal falsely in my faithfulness. My covenant I will not violate, nor will I alter the utterance of my lips. Once I have spoken by my holiness, I will not lie to David. His descendants shall endure forever. And his throne is the sun before me. He shall be established forever like the moon. And the witness in the sky is faithful. No one's going to replace the Jews because God has never rejected them. He says, I'll be faithful to them forever. You, the Gentiles, going to get grafted into them. That's the way that works. And those Jewish people who have yet responded to the Jewish Messiah, in the end, there'll be a mighty revival, and many of them will come in as well. That is the Israel of God. The Jew first, and then the Gentile. So don't be deceived. Don't be caught up in this rising of anti-Semitism throughout the world. You see it throughout the world. Yeah. They're grafted in to the believing Jewish remnant. And the greater Israel is still the Israel of God, even if we're disobedient. Never forget that. Never forget that. We are all saved, both Jews and non-Jews, Jews and Gentiles, by grace through faith in the promised seed. By grace through faith in the promised seed. To the Jew first, and then to the Gentile. We are one. Stand with Israel, fight with Israel, love Israel, and know that in doing that, you will find your own perseverance. Hallelujah. Unscripted, live, unplugged. Thank you, Elder Dennis, for bringing the message today. Thank you, everyone, for all of your work to make this a great service today. And to each and every one of you, your loved ones, Shabbat Shalom.
Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, this is the way you shall bless the children of Israel. Say to them, may Yahweh bless you and keep you. May Yahweh make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. May Yahweh lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace." And we add, "In the name of Yeshua, our Messiah, the Prince of Peace, so you shall put my name on the children of Israel, and I will bless them." Yivarech Adonai ve'yishmerecha. Yaher Adonai panav alecha ve'yihunecha. Yisa Adonai panav alecha. Ve'asemlecha shalom. Shabbat shalom.
You've been listening to the Shabbat message delivered by Senior Pastor Mark McClellan. We hope you have found this teaching relevant and challenging for your life. If you are in the Metro Denver area, please join us on Shabbat. Service starts at 1 p.m. and ends at 3 p.m. Kehila Tenuva is located at 8891 Pose Boulevard in Thornton, Colorado, just a few miles north of downtown Denver. For more information, please visit www.graftedin.com. That's www.graftedin.com. Our mailing address is P.O. Box 29993, Thornton, Colorado, 80229. For inquiries, please call 303-761-9948 or email info@graftedin.com. Thank you for listening to the Shabbat message. Shabbat Shalom and Shavua Tov. Shabbat.